Before we get into today's podcast, I wanted to let you know about a special ebook that's yours to download free today. It's called Five Ways to Connect with God, Ancient Practices for Modern Times. It's safe to say that in today's fast-paced culture, we're all seeking more rest and less chaos. Only then can we find true connection with our Creator. Five Ways to Connect to God offers five unique spiritual principles to Christians who may be feeling dry when it comes to their prayer life or spiritual fervor. These include practices such as choosing a word for the year, the power of one-phrase prayers, and the importance of cultivating thankfulness. Some of these principles are hundreds of years old, yet they offer a fresh way to connect us with the living God. Download your copy of Five Ways to Connect to God by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Who controls the levers of power in America? Some are controlled by the House, some by the Senate, others by the President, who nominates Supreme Court justices. They can protect your free exercise of faith or take it away. Their rulings last for generations, impacting your kids and grandkids. Think about choosing your next president, because the ultimate lever of power is controlled by you. Your vote matters because the Supreme Court matters. Paid for by First Liberty Institute.
Welcome to another classic replay from the archives of Unbelievable from March 2015. Ruth Preston, Callum Miller, and Peter S. Williams of the UK Apologetics Facebook group took on a variety of questions from callers. Ben, who lost his faith, wanted to know why God didn't provide him with more evidence. Michael asked, "Why should I believe Paul?" Tim wanted to know why evangelicals can be so insular, and Brian had questions about the moral argument for God.
Well, today we're doing something a little bit different on Unbelievable. I'm actually joined in my little cubbyhole of a studio today by three guests who join me around the table. And they're all members or have an interest in, a stake in, UK Apologetics. Well, that's both a Facebook group, which you can find by searching on Facebook, or you can go to the blog, which is apologeticsuk.blogspot.co.uk. But I've got Callum Miller, who is a medical student. I think you're somewhere along the journey in your medical career, aren't you, Callum? Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, so I'm just coming towards the end of it now. So I've finished my final exams, and now I've just got graduation in July after a few little bits and pieces.
And you've been on the show before, of course, last debating James Croft, wasn't it? Yeah, back in the summer. It was a good debate. So it's good to have you back in studio.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. Peter S. Williams, who was on the show just recently, joins us. Peter, you're kind of not one of the founders of the Apologetics UK group, but you certainly have taken interest in the Facebook group and contribute occasionally to some of the stuff that goes on there, don't you?
No,
not really. Okay, you're just here. You're purely here as a friend, then, in that sense, to the thing.
Yes, what do I? It's a jolly good thing. Well, there's too little time in life for the things that need doing, aren't there? But, I fully support it, and these guys and I are all trustees of the Christian Evidence Society.
Indeed,
as well,
we've been killing many birds with one stone by having a meeting and then coming into studio to have a discussion as well. Ruth Preston also joins me. Ruth. You are a founder and involved in UK Apologetics.
Oh, I am.
How would you describe it? A kind of an informal network of people in the UK who are into apologetics, would that be fair?
Yeah, exactly that. And it's a forum on Facebook where you can ask your questions and people can get together to think about the answers, which I find very useful and productive for myself and I think for everyone else who's involved.
Good. And what's your background? What are you studying at the moment, Ruth?
I'm doing a master's degree in sociology, the sociology of religion.
Good.
Which is, I find, very interesting.
Good. Excellent. Well, what I like about the UK Apologetics Group, and I'm sometimes sort of watching what's going on there as well, is obviously it's essentially aimed, at least the Facebook group is aimed at people who have an interest. It's not for necessarily atheist, non-Christian and Christian debating, as it were. It's more for exchanging ideas between like-minded people,
yes,
so that you can encourage each other and kind of learn to go out and have those conversations and discussions. And
yes, exactly. It's an in-house group, as it were. But we aim to be able to help each other answer objections that, you know, anyone anyone can ask us at any time. So,
great stuff. Okay, and what I like about it as well is it seems to have sort of been primarily driven by a fairly young group of people who just wanted to have that kind of a network and have it online and so on. So if you do want to pick it up and see what happens and join the group and so on, if you're interested in apologetics, then why not seek it out on Facebook, UK Apologetics, or go to the blog. That's apologeticsuk.blogspot.co.uk. Okay, well, we're going to have, as I say, something a bit different today. We're going to take a few calls across the course of the show. Let's call it a Grill an Apologist show. I put out a little call on my own Facebook page for people, atheists, agnostics, skeptics, to get in touch if they'd be interested in contributing to the programme. And so we've got a few of those people who did get back to me lined up today. And the first person who we're going to be talking to is Ben Watts, based here in the UK. He's an ex-evangelical Christian, actually. He grew up in a New Frontiers church before losing his faith. And he wants to tackle a particular objection, sort of one of the things that he finds interesting about the fact that he did lose his faith. So welcome along to the programme, Ben.
Hello, good to be here.
It's great to have you with us, and thanks for being willing just to throw your hat into the ring and come on the programme. We're not going to have as much time as we normally do for the interaction, so it'll be kind of a more of a mini interaction. But do you want to just spell out what your issue is?
Yeah, sure. I think just the fact that I lost my faith, and I guess there's several things I am convinced by as a scientist, the most obvious being sort of evolution. And I guess thinking about God as being an all-powerful deity who can do anything he so desires, I think it seems a bit weird that he wouldn't give enough evidence to satisfy me and others in our belief. I think especially adding in the fact that, you know, hell, eternal punishment is on the card. So, I mean, I could probably get over it if it was, you know, a slap on the wrist for not believing, but it's something that's, you know, a bit more than that. So, I guess in a nutshell, that's why what the big problem I have.
So if God does exist and it's so important to believe in God, why didn't he offer more conclusive evidence?
The evidence on the level of things like evolution, which is scientific, and, you know, there's actual tangible evidence for it, rather than just the evidence that's sometimes
offered. And when you mention evolution, do you mean by that I can have belief in that because there's enough evidence for it?
I think
it.
So, yeah.
Or are you saying that's an objection to Christianity as well?
I think that's something that I am convinced by as a scientist, that something like, you know, the world being round or evolution being true is based on lots and lots of scientific evidence. And I just wonder why that's not in the same category as the evidence that God offers for his existence.
Okay, well, great question. So let's open this up to those who are with us here in studio. Ruth, do you want to start off with this one?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting question, and one that I think I have thought about in the past myself before as well, although I didn't lose my faith over it. So hopefully I'll be able to bring some ideas that might be useful to you. The first thing is, I think God doesn't always work in the way that we think he might. And I think it can be easy, if God is not revealing himself in the way we expect, to then assume that maybe he's not revealing himself at all. And I don't think that's the case. And so this is me encouraging you that God has revealed himself in what I believe are very persuasive ways. The first one being the existence of morality. That sense of wrong and right in all of us, that sense of what one ought to do, that the aspect of morality that I would argue is objective as well, that transcends culture and history. Another one would be the existence of creation. When you look in the sky of an evening and there's a beautiful sunset, there's something about the beauty in what has been created that really... there's something about beauty which is beyond the scientific realm. An appreciation for beauty can't really be measured in that scientific way. And I think there's something about God in us that recognises beauty and when we see it. Also, just the fact that the universe has been created at all, that the universe is there. So you've got the question, where did the universe come from in the first place? That's a big question that I think for myself is satisfied by my belief in God. Also, still on the same point of the existence of creation, is human beings ourselves, the fact that we are so very different to all the animals in so many ways. I mean, I'm sure that animals are advanced in their own ways. There's some animals which are obviously more intelligent than others, but the degree to which human beings are more advanced than any animal is significant.
From your perspective here, Ben, I guess you might say, well, okay, yes, there are arguments for God. Mm. And what you've effectively described there, Ruth, is a sort of maybe cumulative argument. You know, look at this, look at that, look at the other.
Yeah.
But is your point maybe, Ben, it doesn't impress me overwhelmingly to the point that I just have to accept it?
I think so. And I think the fact that an all-powerful deity of God knows how my brain works and knows that the types of evidence that will convince me, and as using, you know, like going back to evolution as an example of something that has convinced me, it's not like I've completely closed-minded to any sort of evidence whatsoever. There's good examples of evidences that I accept.
You had a bit more to add, I think.
Moving on, it's interesting. You seem to be saying, if I've understood you correctly, that you feel that you would want to be persuaded or compelled to believe in God so that he would provide you with all of the evidences that would leave you without a doubt that he exists. Interestingly, one of Jesus' followers actually asked him a similar question. He said, why have you revealed yourself to us and not to the world? And interestingly, Jesus' answer is that those who love him will obey his teaching. What's interesting about that is he brings in the concept of love. Now, I think that God, in his beauty and his goodness and amazingness, he wants to have a relationship with the creatures that he's created, with us, essentially. And I think that when he created us, he wanted us to love him. And to love someone, you need to be able to choose. I do believe that this is an idea in my head, but I think it makes sense, that if God were to compel you in such a way that you could not deny at all, you would have to follow him, and in the same way, maybe everyone on earth, would he really be creating a situation in which you can choose to love him?
It's an interesting point. In a sense, you're saying there, Ruth, God may have a good reason for not giving you overwhelming evidence for his existence, which is that he wants to leave enough ambiguity that you actually have to kind of make a conscious choice to love and believe and put your trust in such a God. It would almost seem like a forced kind of arrangement if it was so overwhelming that you had no choice but to believe.
Yes, that's an idea of mine. It's not something that's necessarily...
Well, I don't think... It's certainly not the first person I've heard have that idea, in the sense. So I think it's an interesting one. Any thoughts on that, Ben? And then we'll throw it out to the others.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I think the overriding point to me is that I would take that as a good answer if hell and eternal punishment wasn't on the cards. And I think the fact that we're talking about an eternity of punishment or a separation from God, if I don't accept this, to me, I don't mind if God, you know, compels me or forces me to believe in him. It wouldn't matter to me because, you know, I would be believing the correct answer, the correct view. So I think just the fact that this is the outcome, if I don't believe, means that I find that, you know, a not compelling objection for me anyway. So
And I guess at some level it seems a bit unfair that your eternal destiny rests on whether you got were convinced or not by the evidence. Peter S. Williams? Mm.
Sure, I think this is a really crucial point, and following on from this distinction that we've had between merely believing that there's a God or not and responding to God in relationship, I think it's really crucial to point out that the Bible does not say that God arranges hell for simply a lack of belief in God. that it's not that if you fail to believe in the existence of God, then you get sent to hell. I think it's very clear in the Bible that you only end up in hell by knowing that there is a God and consciously deciding to reject relationship with him. Mm. So it's not a lack of belief that there is a God that is the condition of hell, but rather a knowing that there is a God and rejecting him, not wanting anything to do with him. So it's not really the issue of believing that there is a God that's connected to hell. Rather, it's the issue of whether or not you want to be with God in eternity or not that's connected to hell.
Any thoughts on that, Dan?
I think, I guess it's an interesting point, knowing it comes to the debate of once saved, always saved, doesn't it? Of, you know, I did used to believe in God and accepted it and was a Christian, and obviously now I've changed my mind on that. But so, you know, that's a different point. But I think something like someone like Christopher Hitchens, who was quite clear in the things that he said, that I cannot find it within myself to believe in this God, and was obviously never a Christian, makes me think.
But what's interesting, I suppose, with his particular example is he also said, and if there is a God, I will wave my fist at him and say, you're a despicable dictator.
Yeah,
so in a sense, it sounds like he wouldn't want to be wherever God is in the end. He'd want to be, presumably...
Yeah. I think it's just this crucial point it's not about ignorance of God or not that leads to your eternal destination. It's how you respond to your knowledge of God, whenever it is you get that knowledge. And of course Christians have different ideas about whether you might be able to get a knowledge of God after death and before the last judgment and so on, but it's the knowledge of God that you have, how you respond to that, that's the key issue here, rather than ignorance of whether or not God happens to exist.
Bringing it back to the idea of loving God, you know, that he said that if God did exist he would wave his fist at him. Which is an interesting point there, isn't it? When Jesus says, those who love me will know me, those who do not will not. Essentially, that seems to be the implication of what he's saying. And I would say, actually, Christopher Hitchens fits that description. Mm. And that was just a point I thought.
I knew it would be the case when we're taking quite a few calls, but inevitably we could have gone on for the whole show because it sounds like it would be a really interesting one to draw out further. What if I promise you, Ben, that we'll get you on for a proper discussion at some point?
Yeah,
and we'll be able to tease this out a bit further.
That'd be really great. Thank
It'd
you.
Be
yeah,
good, wouldn't it? Yeah,
brilliant.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks for make yourself available. Anyway,
thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Special edition of the show today. I'm joined by three people, all involved in apologetics in the UK. Two of them, Callum and Ruth, both founder members of the UK Apologetic Facebook group. It's also got a blog as well you can visit. Links from today's show at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Peter S. Williams is sort of just joining us for the ride, really. He's a Christian philosopher, writer, has contributed to a few shows here on Unbelievable in his own time too. And we've got another guest on the line, and we very truly are an international show, Unbelievable. So we're going to New York now to hear from, and forgive me if I mispronounce this, but is it Michael Vinciguerra?
You're close enough, yes.
Okay. Vinci Guerra, would that be correct?
There you go.
Okay, Vinci Guerra. Michael, lovely to talk to you. Thanks for coming on the programme today. Just a very kind of, we're just having kind of short interactions on the programme today, but you've got an interesting question. It's more of a biblical question, I think. So do you want to just put this to us and we'll see what the panel have to say?
Well, sure. It's probably one that they've heard a few times, and it comes more from the Muslim side against Christianity, I guess it would be. I don't understand how Christians overlook everything Jesus said, not everything Jesus said, but they place more faith in Paul and his writings when he never met the physical Jesus. We don't really, I mean, if you really want to base your faith on Christianity, you have to base it on Paul, because he disallows some things which Jesus absolutely allowed and had done. So I don't know how you can believe in Christianity by following Paul. That's probably my question.
That's an interesting one. So in a sense, because so much Christian doctrine is dependent on what Paul said and wrote in the Bible.
Pretty much, yes. Or what he didn't say.
And yet he himself never physically met Jesus. So we're kind of placing an awful lot of faith in Paul, in that sense, is what you're saying.
Yeah, in Paul, before you even place your faith in Jesus. You have to assume Paul did have this revelation. And if you assume that it was a revelation, how do you know? How does Paul know it was Jesus? It could have been, and if you believe in this kind of stuff, couldn't it have been a demon?
Okay, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. How do we know? Okay, lots in that question, in a way. So we haven't given you a chance to respond yet, Callum, so maybe we'll start with you this time. Callum Miller, what would you say to this kind of an objection?
Yeah, hi, Michael, thank you. That's actually a really good question. And when I read it the first time last night, I was actually, you know, I thought this actually isn't a question I get particularly often. It is a really important one. The first thing I guess I would say is that if there is a conflict between Jesus and Paul, as you say, Jesus should be given priority. I think most Christians will probably say that there isn't much tension between them, and so they're happy to accept both. But I would agree with you that if there is any kind of surface conflict, I think we should give Jesus the kind of priority there. And I think it would be a bad thing if we were taking Paul as kind of the main figure of Christianity, because he's not. Obviously, the main figure is Jesus. Now, the question is, how do we know that there's a really tight relationship between Paul and Jesus, so that Paul and Jesus were saying roughly the same things? And I think one of the useful things that can be done here is, and what I did last night was I kind of traced out a diagram of just a few people involved and looked at the links between them. And so I looked at St. Paul, St. Peter, who was Jesus' kind of number one disciple, and then I looked at Mark, the author of Mark's Gospel, who, according to many church references and in church tradition, was a follower of Peter. And I also looked at Luke, who accompanied Paul on some of his journeys. And what I did was I looked through all the biblical references and the early church references to see which links we could draw between all four of these people. And actually, there were a surprising number of links between them. So just as an example, between Peter and Paul, there are lots of meetings. Paul mentions a couple in Galatians chapters 1 and 2. Luke mentions meetings between Paul and Peter in the book of Acts. He talks about three times that Paul went to Jerusalem where Peter was. And Paul in Galatians talks about Peter coming to Antioch to see Paul. Sorry if that got a little bit confusing. But there are a kind of number of meetings between Paul and some of the key disciples and people interested in Christianity, and a lot of the people who were followers of Jesus from the start. And so actually, go on.
There's also animosity in there, though.
I mean, are you referring to kind of the circumcision debate?
Well, that would be one. Actually, that was my main one, only because Jesus was, Peter was, Paul was. Jesus never said to stop it. So it's like, that's one of my main ones, yes.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. And so, like, I think that's an important thing. And what I thought here was that there's actually only really a surface tension between Paul and Peter on this issue. So if you look at Galatians chapter 2, where Paul talks about his meeting with Peter in Antioch, it's never actually said that Peter thought that Gentiles should be circumcised. What Paul is pointing out is that Peter's practices were kind of hypocritical and they were varying depending on who Peter was with. Whereas actually, if we look at the account of Peter's views on the question of circumcision, if we go to Acts 15, for example, we actually find Peter explicitly saying that actually the Gentiles don't need to be circumcised, and that there are, you know, he lays out a few moral kind of doctrines which the Gentile Christians should be following. And you get that in Acts 21 as well, taking the example away from Peter and towards James. Some people think there might be a bit of conflict there. But again, in Acts 21, James talks about Paul as, you know, his beloved brother in Christ. And there's lots of kind of flattering and family language in there. And so I think any tension to do with the circumcision debate is actually kind of on a surface level. Whereas if you look at the accounts in Acts, although there's certainly some disagreement, what we find here is that actually Paul and the church in Jerusalem and the early followers of Jesus all had a great love for each other and they respected each other. And they actually did agree on circumcision and on quite a few of the moral doctrines they give there in Acts 15.
I mean, is your problem essentially, Michael, that Paul sort of builds on what Jesus establishes? And so for you, that's questionable, because in the end, you know, why trust Paul over Jesus?
Well, exactly. And also, actually, you just brought up another good point. Yes, it says it in Acts. The problem is that Acts is clearly biased towards Paul. We don't know that that's what actually happened.
You're saying we don't get Peter's perspective on what happened. We get Luke's kind of version.
Exactly. We only get Luke which is pretty much Paul's, I would say, or at least in the Pauline camp, we never really hear what Peter says about that.
Okay. Quick response, Callum?
Yeah, I guess just one thing before I hand over to Ruth here is just that if there was a real conflict between Paul and Peter and Luke was biased in favour of Paul in the Book of Acts, which we might grant for the sake of argument, if there was a real conflict and there was that bias, we would actually expect Acts to be more kind of damning towards Peter. And what we find is actually in Acts, Luke, although he might note that Peter and Paul disagreed, for example, he is nevertheless very respectful about Peter. He says things about Peter which would be, you know, of great honour in the early church, about how Peter was willing to suffer for the church and so on. But that I just said that quickly, and now I'll hand it over to Ruth.
Well, let's hand it over to Ruth. Ruth, a few thoughts from you before we have to start to
Interestingly, I've thought about it a lot because, as you mentioned at the beginning, Muslims bring this up quite a lot, and I'm very interested in evangelism to Muslims. I just wanted to make a point. You were talking about Acts being written by Luke and therefore being biased towards Paul. I just wanted to highlight the fact that Peter, in his books, 1 and 2 Peter, one of his letters, sorry, he does talk about the sayings of Paul and the other scriptures. So he is clearly, in that sense, endorsing Paul's teaching. And that comes from a letter written by him. So that should provide a little bit more balance to our argument that Peter and Paul did have a good working relationship in the governance of the church.
I mean, any final thoughts, Peter S. Williams, on this, in as much as I suppose the main concern that I'm getting from you, Michael, is, but hang on, do I believe in Jesus or do I believe in Paul if I'm a Christian? And that's a problem for you.
It's not, do I believe in Jesus or do I believe in Paul? I obviously, I believe in neither, either. But for a Christian, I would think, do I follow Jesus or do I follow Paul?
Okay. Is it a dichotomy? Yeah.
I don't think so. I think what these guys have said in their references to Acts and to Peter is right. I think I follow Jesus, and Jesus has provided various bits of scripture that are useful for helping me to do that, and some of them are by Paul, some of them are by Peter, some of them are by James, some of them are by folks we don't know, like the book of Hebrews and so on, and it seems that they are all giving the same basic message. Sure, if one were to find a contradiction between, say, something in Paul and something that Jesus is recorded as saying in the Gospels, one would go with Jesus, but I didn't see any contradictions, as these my colleagues here have pointed out. I don't think there's any contradictions. I think Paul has really extended the hand of fellowship by the Jerusalem church, and they say, we'll do the evangelism to our fellow Jews, you go and do the evangelism to the Gentiles, but we're all singing off the same hymn sheet. And it's one last point I might make. When Paul, in doing his evangelism, say, setting up the church in Corinthians, if you look at 1 Corinthians 15, he talks there about how when he came and set the church up there, he passed on to them the creedal formula that he had received, that he passes on to them in 1 Corinthians 15, which even, you know, really sceptical atheist New Testament scholars like Gerd Ludemann and so on say, this is a creedal formula of early Christian belief that goes back to within, say, 3 years of the crucifixion. Mm-hmm. And it's that message about Jesus' death and resurrection that Paul passes on material that comes from the Jerusalem church.
I'm afraid we're out of time, Michael, and as usual, there's so much more that could be said. Thank you for coming on, though. Really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us from New York.
Not a problem. Thank you very much. Love the show.
Great to
talk
to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Great to talk to you. Okay, we're at the end of part one of Unbelievable today, and we'll be back in just a moment's time taking more questions from listeners from around the world on a special show with my guests from the UK Apologetics Facebook group.
All of us have wondered what happens after we die, and I'm excited to say that N.T. Wright has written an amazing book called Surprised by Hope that provides a fresh perspective and incredible insight on this crucial subject. This powerful book is our gift to you today to say thank you for your financial support of Premier Insight this month. Dive deep into the biblical understanding of life after death and how it can transform your life. Supplies are limited, so don't miss out. Go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. And don't forget to request your copy of Surprised by Hope. Thanks for your support.
Welcome back to the second part of Unbelievable Today with me, Justin Brierley, and doing things a bit differently on the show today. Not one guest in studio, not two, but three. And we're all squeezing into one of our small studios here at Premier Towers. In fact, we're all sharing, well, all my guests are sharing one mic, so we're sort of swinging it between them as we go. But it's good fun, and we're certainly getting to know each other better than we did just before we walked into the studio. And we're also getting to know a few people, sort of having short interactions from a few people that I got in touch with before today's show. I put it out on my Facebook page. Do you want to be involved? Are you an atheist, agnostic? Would you like to put an objection to the guys from UK Apologetics who are coming into studio? And a few of you got in touch, and one of them was Tim Skellett. Tim is actually Australian by birth, lives in Germany, but was raised somewhere else, so has an unusual accent. Tim, thank you for joining us on the programme today.
Thank you very much, Justin.
It's great to have you on. Okay, well, let's jump straight into things. What's your objection to Christianity that you wanted to put to the guest today?
I don't want to make any general objections to Christianity as such. I would like to make a couple of remarks about Christians, if okay. You all don't mind.
No, we won't take
one
offense.
Of those, sorry?
We won't take offense.
Okay, right, sorry, my apologies. One of those main points is fear, that a lot of Christians, especially younger ones, tend to live in fear of the outside world, which they artificially cut off from themselves, and try to build up what they think is an alternative Christian society to the society outside without really engaging with the society outside. That leads to a very false picture of what's actually happening out there. It also makes Christians very manipulable, and they are often manipulated by people who are out to scam. And the basis of fear is both psychologically and emotionally and philosophically very bad, because it makes for somebody who's used to living in fear. If you're going to be a Christian, I would suggest strongly you be courageous in your life. I don't mean that you shout that you're Christian to everybody. That's exactly not what I mean. But I mean that you actually try to live a faith and life based on courage, not on fear.
It's a really interesting point you make there. And I'm trying to, I suppose, get my head around what particularly you have in mind there, Tim. So are you referencing, for instance, that, I don't know, that certain parts of the evangelical church in America kind of maybe adopt a bit of a bubble mentality where they create their own culture and don't want to kind of, I don't know, interact with mainstream culture? What sort of specific examples do you have in mind?
Okay. I will give you a few specific examples, if you will please all forgive me.
It's all right.
I'm not only talking about America, I'm also talking about Australia, where I know Christians very well, and Britain to a large degree, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I first came to Germany, I was struck by German Christians drinking beer in the foyer, not in the church itself, but in the foyer of a church with a celebration, because I was used to English-speaking Christians being very Puritan, yeah?
Okay.
And this from Australia, but also partly from Britain. And then, that's one example, or with Christian music, so-called, yeah? The Christian music industry, or the Christian film industry, which, as you would point out, is mainly American, yeah? But we also know that a lot of the American culture is beginning to influence Britain, and that in a bad way. And
okay.
That includes the worse of the so-called Christian culture over there, which is very different from the British experience, historically and pragmatically. Sorry.
I think I get a sense of then, a little better what you're referring to when you talk about Christians having some sense of fear, and it's that they kind of, I guess, yes, there might be a tendency to yes, make everything, you know, safe. A Christian version of the music that you listen to, and a Christian version of the films that so you don't have to watch the mainstream ones. It's an interesting point, Tim. Ruth, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's very interesting hearing what you have to say. Partly because I haven't been to America or Australia I've visited Germany, but I've not visited any of the churches out there. I suppose I can only really give you my personal story because I haven't met the Christians that you've met. However, I can say from my perspective, my interactions with Christians, my fellow Christians, and my understanding of my own life is dramatically different from the one that you've just described. I think I was interested as well about the ignorant loathing of much of the outside world. I mean, actually, my personal story has been very different to that. Oh. I was brought up as a Christian, but then I rebelled and did the whole sex, drugs, rock and roll. I thought that was what was cool. But I soon pined after my relationship with God. I loved God so much and I wanted that back. That was much more important to me and is much more important to me than anything else in the world. And so I came back to Christianity and I honestly believe that my life is better now than it was back then. And it's not because I deny myself necessarily. There are a few things that I do deny myself just because it's a personal choice. But it's actually, God has helped me to realise that everything that has been created for good. And actually, quite often, the things that we do wrong in life are a corruption of that. So, for example, the drinking is a perfect example. Getting drunk is not good, but having a drink is a good thing that should be enjoyed with friends and family.
It's fascinating to hear, obviously, you feeling like, A, you don't recognise the kind of culture necessarily that Tim's describing, but that in your own experience, you're certainly you haven't, as it were, hidden yourself away from the world. You experienced everything
it had to
offer.
I experienced it all, but in rollercoaster style.
It did not satisfy in the end.
No.
I suppose in a sense, though, it's important, if you like, not everyone can have that testimony of I went and did the prodigal son thing and came back again. But that even if we don't have that, we're still kind of clued in. We're not kind of somehow shielded in our Christian communities from the reality of life and so on. Is that your worry, Tim, that sometimes Christian communities can tend to be a bit insular in that way? Is that your fear?
Well, yes, insularity is, of course, a leading problem. May I ask Ruth a question, please? And this question also goes to Justin and to everybody else.
Sure.
Okay. Now, let's assume that you think that a little bit of spark of God, if your God is worthwhile, is in everybody. Okay?
I believe that we're made in the image of God.
Yeah, that's a different thing, as you're to know. Okay, allow me to go straight through to my question.
Okay.
And that is, do you see a value, and this is a question for you, Ruth, and for Justin, and for everybody there.
Sure.
In doing exactly what you're doing now, that is interacting, say, with somebody like me who's a hardline atheist, but who is not an anti-theist. Yeah, you get the difference?
Yeah.
Do you see a value in interacting and learning from each other? I'm not talking about existence of God arguments.
Sure.
They're sterile and they go nowhere. They only go in circles.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm talking about important things of life and learning from each other. Do you think that's possible, or do you see Christians as not really having anything to learn from non-Christians, including atheists?
Really good question. In answer to that, I can tell you that one of my best friends is a very strong atheist. I've known her for many years, and there's many things I've learned from her. There's also many things that we disagree on. Because I fundamentally and faithfully and very strongly believe in Jesus Christ, that he's the Son of God, that he's the Saviour of my life, and we will debate that avidly. But having said that, we discuss politics, and she is a very intelligent woman. I don't believe she's right about her belief of Christianity and her belief about God and metaphysics, and we discuss that in depth. But there are many things that I can learn from her, and I love her very deeply.
Great answer. Let's pass it over, because it's been fascinating to get a little bit of insight into your life as well, Ruth. But what's your perspective on this, Peter Williams?
I think this is a real salient point that our friend in Germany makes, and a real call that the church should heed and pay attention to, and that it is not godly to be insular and sort of pietistic. There's certainly traditions within the church today and historically that have been sort of pietistic, insular, inward-looking, wanting to protect Christians from the evils of the world and so on. The thing is that is by definition unbiblical, because it stops you from following Jesus' call to be salt and light in the world. You know, the phrase that's sometimes heard, being in the world but not of it, is not in the Bible, actually. But it's a kind of good kind of paraphrase of the New Testament approach to the world. Everybody, whether they're a believer or not, is made in the image of God, is valuable, is precious, and Christians should celebrate people and culture as well. I think Christians have sometimes a deserved reputation of simply being critical about popular culture, about films, about music, and so on. And of course, because people are fallen, that fallenness gets reflected in our art and our culture and politics and society and so on. So there are things that Christians rightfully want to be critical of. But there will also be good things that the church should be known for celebrating and saying, yeah, there's good things in art, whether it's made by a Christian or not.
I mean, in a sense, what you've given us isn't an objection, it's more an observation that you've had about the Christian church in your experience, Tim. But obviously, our guests here saying that's either not their experience or they agree it shouldn't be the way it is if it is in places. Maybe just time for one more reflection from our other guest in the studio here, Callum Miller.
Yeah, thank you for calling in, Tim. And it's been really interesting to hear your experience. And I'm sorry you've had that experience in so many cases. I just quickly kind of emphasize my own experience. And you might be glad to know that just the other day, a few days ago, I unfollowed about half the Christians on my Facebook because all they were talking about was church things or American politics. And I thought it was just incredibly unhelpful. And I've encouraged and spoken to a lot of Christians since then. Telling them, you know, you need to be engaging with non-Christians, not just on these issues about God's existence or about Jesus, but just in the general things in life, things you go through, whether you have children or sports you both enjoy. I've really encouraged other Christians to be talking and engaging with their non-Christian friends about this. And this is what I do all the time with the non-Christians that I live with at the moment. And we have a really good time. And so I'd encourage you that there are, although we make mistakes as Christians and so on, there are plenty of Christians around who really do want to engage and be genuine friends with non-Christians like yourself. So, yeah, thank you for calling in.
Yeah, thank
good
you.
Good on you. Thank you.
Anything you want to add before we have to go?
No, I could have told you one more funny story, but it sounds like you've got very little time left.
Oh, no. So I've got time for a funny story. Tell me your funny story.
Okay, in my blog, I did detail such an experience of a relative of mine in Melbourne in Australia. Now, Melbourne is famously, it has a church on every second corner and a pub on every first corner. Yeah? It's not an unchristian city. But my relative suddenly announced she wanted to form a Christian dog walkers club in what is practically a mainly Christian country in a Christian city. And you think to yourself, isn't this, one, a tiny bit superfluous, and two, hideously arrogant? Obviously, she only meant true Christians,
right,
as per her definition. I won't go into that. But the third point is, what is the use of this? We're talking about walking dogs. And as far as I know, if your God is real and your God is worthwhile, your God is not going to make any difference between how a dog is walked. I don't believe that the fallenness you speak of would be so terribly reflected even in that sphere.
I mean, having said all that, and it is a good example, I suppose, Tim, I mean, I think most Christians would say that, but yes, we should be in the world, we should be absolutely having relationships with people who aren't Christians, of course we should, but there is also value in gathering together, i.e. it's what you do at church on a Sunday. You gather with other like-minded Christians because it is a form of encouragement and fellowship and everything else. And in that sense, it is, to some extent, yes, a kind of an exclusive kind of a thing. Not that you stop anyone coming in, but it is, if you like, a place specifically where Christians gather together. Now, presumably you don't object to that, per se, even if we don't take it to the level of forming dog-walking clubs. Yeah, it's an interesting one. But thank you for telling us that. Anyway, Tim.
May I give you one very last example very quickly?
Go on then.
I've just thought of it. In Britain, in England, above all in England, in the late 1600s, as clergymen became ever more Puritan, there was a very real Puritan wave throughout the late 1600s, the 1700s. Churches of the Church of England started more and more isolating their choirs. Before then, the church choir had quite often also been the village choir, quite secular. They would do both secular and church. And clergymen started banning that. They said the church choir should only perform in church. This led to a withdrawal of the church from the world. It led to a gradual withdrawal of the church from village life and a great loss for the community itself, the village, because every village and town needs every support mechanism it can get, and for the church, because as the church gradually separated itself off, eventually, 300 years later, you have all the problems that the Church of England has today and a hugely declining membership.
Well, I don't think you'll find any argument in the sense that no need to apologise, but no argument that's certainly not something anyone here would want to see happen in terms of, we're all obviously for the integration of church with the community as far as possible. But great to have you on. Thank you, Tim, and all the best. We'll let you get on with things now. Thanks for calling in from Germany. Great to talk to you.
Cheers.
Thank you. Bye.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Okay, well, the final caller on today's programme, as we take various calls and objections to Christianity, or observations at least about Christianity, from a number of listeners to the programme from around the world. He's Brian Broom, based out in California. He's a former Baptist. He lost his faith, though, and he actually started the Atheist Community of San Jose 2 years ago, which has grown to some 500 people who are associated with it. Brian, welcome along to the programme.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. Brian, I think your question is about the moral argument, which is something we've covered a few times on Unbelievable over the years. Do you want to just briefly spell out what the issue is, and we'll see what our folks have to say here?
Sure. So I've had this conversation with many Christians, and it seems to never get past a certain point. We usually can't define objective morality in the first place, but if we do, we can't get past the idea of a good example of what that objective morality is and where that comes from. So maybe you guys can talk about that a little bit.
Okay, well, maybe it'd be good just to define, first of all, for those who maybe are tuning in who aren't even sure what the moral argument is. Maybe Peter S. Williams, do you want to just quickly do that for us before we come to the question of whether we can even talk about objective morality?
Okay, so a pretty standard version of the moral argument would go along these lines. It would start with the observation that in our moral experience we come across certain moral duties or prescriptions that are, and this is the crucial term here, objective rather than subjective. That is, they are things that are true, that we can be wrong or right about, regardless of our personal preferences, what we choose or decide, or our culture chooses or decides, and so on, that they are facts about reality, as it were. The second premise would then be that the best explanation for the existence of such moral facts is the existence of a good God. Mm-hmm. And if those two premises are true, then it follows that there is such a God.
Right. And what it turns on is this idea that there is such a thing as objective moral facts, rather than the morality we adopt simply being a subjective aspect of our culture and so on.
That's right.
So coming back to you then, Brian, what's your issue with this? Is it that you've never been really understood or been given a good example of an objective moral fact? What's the issue?
Yeah, I think that's true. I haven't been given a very good example of a moral fact, and I think usually when it does come up, whether it's murder or something along those lines, we always end up sort of going back and forth about whether or not that's truly an objective fact, and also whether or not God is bound by these objective truths as well, because sometimes there's a loophole that God is not bound by the same objective morality that we are.
Okay, so there's a couple of questions there. So, okay, do you want to try and give us an objective moral fact?
Sure, and I think there's two levels at which I'd approach this. One, of course, level is to try and just give an example, and an example that philosophers typically use here is something like, it is wrong to torture small children just for the fun of it.
Okay.
So that excludes a discussion about, well, maybe I could think of some circumstance where there could be some
overriding
reason that would mean it would be the right thing.
The fate of the world was at stake or
somehow.
Something.
Okay. So that's the kind of typical example people will use. But then I think at a deeper level as well, we not only have these intuitions that certain things are objectively right or wrong, like it's being wrong to torture small children for fun, but they also have this deep intuition that what we decide about moral issues actually really matters, that we put lots of effort into thinking, well, what is the right thing to do? Even if we might think, well, we're fallible, and maybe at the end of our discussion we'll get it wrong. But even to have the intuition that you could get it wrong and that morality really matters and therefore it's worth putting lots of effort into thinking about, well, what is the right thing to do, shows that we have this deep intuition that there are objective rights and wrongs, and that we can get morality wrong, even if any example that we might come up with, we might think, well, we're fallible, so we could be wrong about that, you see.
Yeah.
But to think, well, I could be wrong about it implies that there's something to get right or wrong.
And I don't know about you, Brian, but I often find, interestingly, many atheists sort of tacitly assuming at some kind of objective moral standard. So when they criticise someone for being homophobic, for instance, they're saying, it's actually wrong to be homophobic. You know, there's a right and wrongness about this. It's not just my opinion. It's not just the culture I happen to live in. If people were homophobic back in the 1500s, that was wrong then, just as much as it's wrong today. But do you have a problem with the idea then of that kind of an objective moral fact? Are you in that sense a subjectivist when it comes to morality?
I think I do fall in the subjective side, but I think it's more because if we're for the homosexuality argument, I think we've changed our mind more because we understand it better. We had more information.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're back in the 1500s and we're using simply a biblical understanding of homosexuality is wrong just because God says so, but then as we grow and understand what that actually is and that it's not actually an immoral thing. We see it in nature. It's actually quite normal. So we change our minds. And I don't think there's anything that's objective about that. I don't think there's a truth buried in there. I think that we're just discovering things, and it changes over time.
But if we're discovering things, doesn't it mean that there is a fact to be discovered? I guess that's what I'm driving at, is that, well, yes, of course, people have disagreed about homosexuality down the years, but what you're saying is we've arrived at the truth of the matter. I mean, that's what you seem to be saying.
Yeah, and I at least right now it seems that we do. I mean, we're all not in agreement, but most of us can agree to something. But I also think that it has to do with what type of world we want to live in. If torturing babies for fun is an example I've heard before, but it's not something that I can use as far as, well, here's an example of when I was asked to torture a baby for fun and I said no. But if you go to, like, say, just say stealing, and you say, well, is stealing wrong? Is it wrong to steal something? And you're in that situation of going, well, I could take this, I could steal this, or I could not steal this. And usually in my mind, it's more of a, well, what kind of a world do I want to live in? Do I want to live in a world where people just steal all the time and steal my things, and it's just bedlam? Or do I want to live in a world where we respect each other's property?
But even there, you see, you seem to be thinking in terms of certain conceptions of reality, certain ways of living, certain societies being better than others, and that if one way of living is a better way of living, that you feel you have some sort of duty to pursue that way of life rather than the other ways of life that are not good. And so constantly coming through here is this underlying intuition that there's something to be right or wrong about, to get true or falsity in our descriptions of what way of life is better, what way of organising society, you know, is better.
Because if say there was some sociopath who said, no, I much prefer a society where people can go around stealing from each other, some kind of anarchist or something, would you be prepared to say to them, Brian, you're wrong about that, that's not the best way society should be? Or would you say, well, that's your opinion, I've got mine?
Well, I don't think I can enforce a sociopath to adhere to my worldview, but again, what kind of God would create sociopaths?
Well, that's a bit of a different question, but yeah, I mean,
right.
Okay.
I was just going to say, does it make sense that, or does it make more sense that we have these rules that we are sort of developing as we progress in society, or that they've come down from more of a higher power that we're just discovering? I guess that's kind of the bigger question.
Yeah. Well, that is exactly the key question, and that's sort of the question of the other premise of the argument. One premise is the issue of, are these moral duties and things objective or not? The other is that, given that they're objective, what's the best explanation of them? So that's the other premise then that you're turning to. Mm.
Well, look, folks, we'll carry on this conversation with Brian after a short break. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, special guest from the UK Apologetics Facebook group, as we take some interesting calls from sceptics. So we've been taking calls across the course of today's show from a variety of people who I got in touch with after putting up a message on my Facebook page, the Unbelievable Facebook page, saying, would you like to come on a show and interact with some of the members of the UK Apologetics Facebook group? Well, we've heard all of our callers, and we're just in the middle of this conversation with Brian Broom, who's calling in from California in the United States, talking about the moral argument. And so maybe just as we pick this up again, maybe you'd like to give your comments on this particular way of looking at things, Callum.
Yeah, it's kind of a bit of a tangent, because I actually don't normally kind of endorse the standard moral argument. So this might throw a bit of a kind of curveball into the works. But I just want to kind of throw out the suggestion, I guess, of a different kind of moral argument, which is to do with moral knowledge. And the argument here goes as follows. If atheism is true, if God doesn't exist, it's very difficult to account for moral knowledge. There's no reason why we would expect our moral beliefs in general to line up with moral reality, or, you know, the actual moral fact about the world. But if theism is true, there's good reason to think that we have moral knowledge, because God would want to give us moral knowledge so that we can act responsibly towards each other. And so if you follow those two kinds of premises, you can actually conclude that our having moral knowledge, the fact that we do know things about the moral world, is actually good evidence for God. Obviously, that might not be the moral argument you wanted to talk about, but there's just something to throw out as well.
What you're essentially saying there is that if we live in a godless universe, an atheistic worldview, if you like, there's no particular reason why we would arrive at the right knowledge about these moral facts. Let's say that there are moral facts about the way we should live and so on, but there's no particular reason why we would have got to know about them if there wasn't some kind of guiding force pointing us in that direction. Is that kind of where I'm getting at?
Yeah, so there are, I guess, a few reasons why you might think that if God doesn't exist, our moral beliefs aren't really justified, because, for example, moral facts don't have any kind of causal relationship with the world. They can't. So we normally know that there's a desk in front of me, for example, because the desk causes photons to reflect onto my retina, and then I see the desk, and then I know that there's a desk in front of me. But we don't really have any analogous kind of knowledge in the case of morality. It's not really the case that there are moral facts which cause anything in us, so it's hard to see how we can have that kind of knowledge about it.
Did you follow much of that, Brian? I mean, does this help at all in terms of helping to kind of elucidate what the argument is and how you might arrive at it if you do believe in moral facts?
Yeah, I think we're, because a lot of times we're talking about, you know, these concepts and the words that are associated with them. So, like, love is kind of a nebulous concept in some ways, because you love in different ways with different people. So I think morals is kind of in that realm where you're talking about something that we have that we all can agree on, that it's something, but we're not exactly sure, you know, what it is outside of itself. We can't exactly point to it as a thing, right? Like a desk, you can't just say, well, this is morals. It's a little more conceptual than that. So I don't know. I think adding the God to it doesn't really help, except for being an easy answer. I don't think it actually helps to explain much.
Callum, do you want to come back on that?
So are you saying that there is a problem in understanding how we have knowledge about moral facts, or are you saying that there isn't a problem anyway, and it's easy to know, you know, we can see why we have knowledge of moral facts?
Well, no, I think that morals are still subjective, so I don't think we've come to any massive conclusion of truth. I think that we are discovering things about what works best in our societies. And
but again, you use the word best,
which
suggests that there are worse and better ways, which suggests that there's some kind of standard out there by which we could measure it. So are you tacitly smuggling in an assumption about the objectivity of morality by using even a term like the best way to live and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. So I would probably go back to kind of the Sam Harris model of the well-being of conscious creatures. If we're sort of using that as a baseline, and again, this is an agreement that we have in our society, right? We're not talking about, because the sociopaths would not agree, right? We can't get them to get on board with the well-being of conscious creatures. But for the majority of our society, we can. And I think that if we use that as a baseline as being more of the best way to deal with these issues, you know, that example's come up about, you know, is it good to drink bleach or not good to drink bleach? I think we can all agree that it's not good. You know,
what we can agree on is it will damage your internal organs. I don't know whether that actually says anything about the morality. That's a different kind of area, is it? I mean, come back to you, Peter S. Williams, you wanted to...
Yeah, it's just interesting mentioning Sam Harris. I've read Sam Harris's book where he tries to defend... he believes in objective morals, but he tries to say that science can give you knowledge of objective morals. But actually, he explicitly contradicts himself in that book and gives the story away and says that science cannot justify scientifically the assumption that you have to make to buy into his ethical system that he gives there, which is that you have to assume that the flourishing of sentient creatures is a good thing. He says the demand for that radical justification of saying, no, nihilism is, that kind of subjectivist nihilism about morals is false, is something that science can't decide for you. You have to accept that at the basis of his system. But that's a moral metaphysical intuition about objective right and wrong.
So as far as you're concerned, the whole thing is a question begging exercise,
yeah,
because
absolutely.
He's assumed the whole thing he was meant to be proving.
Yeah, and he explicitly says that.
Well, okay. Well, look, we're running out of time, and it's a shame because we again only just scratching the surface of this one. But that's the way it is when you do a lot of stuff in the course of just one show. It's been really interesting though, Brian, getting your take on that. Do you feel like that any kind of thing could be put to you to convince you that there is an objective moral fact? You know, I can imagine a lot of people who maybe think they're relativists maybe stop being quite so relativistic when their child has been abducted or something. You know, I'm sure most people would say that's absolutely wrong, full stop.
Right.
You know, I a lot of people. And I think a lot of people do go through life actually assuming, whether they call it that or not, the reality of objective moral facts. But do you really believe that none of that actually really is a case of right or wrong? It's just about kind of, I don't know, a biological advantages they confer on us and that kind of thing?
Well, I think it does have a lot to do with our sense of empathy. And I mean, that's obviously, without the, you know, in the entire primate world, is the sort of empathy that we see, and I think really morals are just sort of an extension of that. And I haven't been given a really good example of something that you can test as a definite objective truth that is always the case. at least everything that I've come across has been subjective, and I'm okay with that, but I would like to be convinced otherwise.
Okay. Well, look, it's been very interesting to speak to you. Thank you for joining us on the line today, all the way from California, Brian. And thanks for listening to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that draws to a close our interactions today on the programme. Thanks again to Callum, Ruth and Peter, who have joined me in studio, all gathered round a microphone. It's been a friendly interaction, and it's been good to have a few different people interacting. If you want to find out more about Peter S. Williams, peterswilliams.com, I think, is the place to go. But you can, if you're interested in, you know, finding like-minded apologists, and you don't have to be from the UK. I think you accept people outside the UK on the Facebook group as well, do you, Callum?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Check that out. Search for them on Facebook, UK Apologetics, or go to the blog, apologeticsuk.blogspot.co.uk. But from Ruth, Callum and Peter, thank you very much for being with me on the programme today.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's Classic Replay. Do let us know what you thought. You can email us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or leave a comment on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/premierunbelievable, or tweet us at unbelievablefe. For more resources for exploring faith, head over to our website, premierunbelievable.com, and if you register there, you'll unlock access to all the content on the website, and we'll send you updates and exclusive content through the Premier Unbelievable newsletter, including bonus videos and ebooks. That's premierunbelievable.com. See you next time for another classic replay of Unbelievable.